All right, everybody, before we get started for today's episode, if you guys haven't heard yet, we're doing what we call the Crypto Hedge Fund Summit, and this is June 25th to June 26th. It's completely free. So before you fast forward through this ad, go to CryptoHedgeFundSummit.com and you can sign up for free. We interviewed over 35 hedge fund managers and investors, CEOs, founders, just brilliant, brilliant investing minds. And we got a bunch of nuggets of wisdom, and they're all for you, all for free. And you could watch it from the comfort of your own home.
Recording all these interviews was a very eye-opening experience for me. I feel at least three times smarter than I was before. I listen to all these intelligent people that have decades of experience more than I do, and tremendous analytics tools and quants at their disposal that normal guys like us don't. Go to CryptoHedgeFundSummit.com and get your free ticket today.
All right, all you good citizens of Crypt Nation, it is your hosts, Bryce and Pizza Mind, coming at you from San Diego on lockdown.
You know, there are moments in my life when I just wonder if I've completely wasted it. Not in general, like generally in my life, like I'm obviously very happy. I mean, I'm the co-host of Crypto 101 podcast. That's something I would never sell or get rid of for anything. But there are moments. There are moments where I'm, you know, I should be sitting out at the beach or hanging out with my friends or calling my dad or my aunt or something. But instead, I'm sitting watching Bitcoin range between $10 to $30 in an hour, just wondering when this candle's going to explode.
You've lost your marbles. That's what you have.
I've lost my marbles. I've lost some of my money, and I'm desperately waiting for the Bitcoin halving pump. I'm losing sleep, but it really got me thinking, you know, when you're wasting your life, you really want to do something that matters. You only have one life as far as I know. At least currently, my allotment is only one. I have not found any magic mushrooms that can make me come back to life yet. But if you're going to live here on this planet, you want to do something that really, really matters. And our guest with us today is living his whole life, every moment, and making every moment count. So with us here today, we have Sinjin David Young from the International Blockchain Monetary Reserve. David, welcome to Crypto 101.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
You are doing something super cool for the Southeast Asia banking market that I've never seen before. Of all the copycat projects that come and go in crypto, this is not one of them. Give us a high-level overview, one or two sentences. What exactly is the International Blockchain Monetary Reserve?
Yeah, in a nutshell, it's the IMF of crypto. So we're really bottom-up focused towards the individual, and specifically for the urban working poor and emerging markets.
Tell us what the IMF is.
The International Monetary Fund that was set up after World War II. And it was basically to create kind of stability in these developing markets post World War II. And it's been around, and every single major international financial crisis, where it was 1997 in Asia or in Europe or things like that, they just jump in, especially for Africa and emerging countries. But it's always top down, so they deal with the governments directly. Whereas for us, you know, we're really going bottom up, like directly to the individual themselves. And so that's where the big difference is. And part of that is that we're focusing on creating also a new concept of a micro asset. And it's basically a debt-free source of capital for entrepreneurial investment in these emerging markets.
Very interesting. What you kind of said was interesting. It sounds like a good history lesson. You mentioned after World War II, they had to, you know, the IMF was created for some reason, and that reason was to restructure the world, really, right? I mean,
right.
Restructure debt and reparations and all that kind of stuff. So could you kind of like, I don't know if you're a history nut, but like walk us through maybe a little bit of like what that life was like and after the war, and how the IMF solved this problem, and also like what problems are they tasked with today?
I guess like in really broad strokes, what they learned after World War II was, when you have at the end of World War I, where they had these war reparations on Germany and the effect that it had, then you know the United States came together and they said, okay, like, we'll have the Marshall Plan, and then we're going to help really redevelop these countries. And part of this is the IMF coming in and saying, okay, look, we're going to help structure these countries. And so they're going to develop in a way where, you know, there's transparency, there's proper financial systems in place. And what the IMF has been tasked with in, you know, this kind of post-World War II era is creating these open financial markets. And of course, you know, to the end of this is their, you know, push towards democratizing these markets and the theory that if countries are economically stable, then that creates a level of stability globally, like on a political or geopolitical level. And basically, whenever there is a problem in the international market where, you know, because of globalization, these markets are so interconnected, they literally come in and they say, okay, look, you have these debts, you might default. This is going to bring down this entire region, whether it's Latin America or Southeast Asia or Asia. And here's a payment plan and we will give you this money. But this is what you need to be more structured. This is how you have to fix your kind of corporate governance, so on and so forth. So they're an agency that really lends itself to, how do I say, not just promoting financial markets, but creating and supporting that stability. But, you know, it's totally top down. And so the one thing that IMF doesn't really address is the livelihood of the people in the country that they're helping support, because ultimately, you know, you assume that if an agency like the IMF comes in and they're supporting, you know, your infrastructure, your health, your financial market, so on and so forth, that that's going to have a real trickle down effect. But the thing about it is what people, I guess, we kind of ignore, especially in developed countries, is that, you know, we used to call like the underdeveloped world the third world, and then we call them developing markets, and then we call them emerging markets. And, you know, this terminology has been around since, you know, the end of World War II. And like, how long are these like markets supposed to stay developing or emerging? And so there's a kind of weakness there where this top-down approach hasn't really increased the, I would say, the standard of living for the majority of people in these emerging markets. Because if it did, they wouldn't be emerging markets any longer. And so that's something that we're trying to address here.
That's a great point. I mean, if a system has been in place since the end of World War II and people are still suffering through the same kind of poverty and danger and, you know, health or lack of healthcare access or banking access, at some point you got to cut the cord and do something different. So what are you guys doing at the International Blockchain Monetary Reserve that is different from the IMF?
I think more than anything else, and it's interesting because you have the COVID-19 situation right now where the entire global economy is on lockdown, right? And even here in the United States, where it's the richest country in the entire world, you have it on lockdown. And there's there was one presidential candidate on the Democratic side. His name was Andrew Yang. And, you know, eventually he had dropped out of the running. But he had really pushed forth this thing called UBI, Universal Basic Income. He called it the Freedom Dividend. And shortly after the lockdown occurred, all the cracks in the system where people only really had enough savings for like a month or less than a month started to appear. And he says, you know, I was talking about automation, but I should have been talking about a pandemic to make people really understand how critical UBI is. And the entire thing about UBI, universal basic income, is that, you know, everyone gets $1,000 or $2,000 a month and as a, you know, kind of base income for everybody. Now, I'm not supporting UBI particularly, but in the terms of actually getting aid directly to individuals, you know, this is where something that is decentralized, that doesn't have any intermediaries, can really be effective and can be, you know, noted and seen. Because if you see, like in the United States right now, you have these small business loans that were given out. But all the people who had established banking relationships at the big banks, public companies, franchises, big corporations, they were able to get the loans first. Whereas the people who were not as organized, who were not established in the system, who really needed them as small businesses, were not able to get access. And so in the same way, at an even more extreme level, the people that we're dealing with are the urban working poor, and these people are basically living not month to month, they're living like day to day. And they're pretty much out of the system. But in Southeast Asia, amazingly enough, the mobile and the internet infrastructure is really there. I mean, you can buy a smartphone for about $100 there that is, you know, made in China, but has Android on it, so on and so forth. And what we're trying to do is directly address the individuals where we are able to provide for them not an airdrop, but access to some form of capital. And the way that we've developed this kind of capital, we call it a micro asset rather than a micro loan. And what we're trying to do is just basically get in the hands, get people to actually have capital, long-term capital or assets in their hands. And so that's the real difference between how we're approaching it, where we're directly going to the individual rather than trying to go through multiple agencies and so on and so forth. Because you think the UN and all these NGOs are great things, UNICEF, they are. They have the same type of overhead that every single centralized organization does have. They have staff they need to pay, so on and so forth. They have procurement costs. And a lot of times, like, that money that you donate or you give, number one is, it's a finite amount of money. You know, you donate it, you think about it, you do it, and then it's there and it's dispersed and then it's done. And the other part of it is that by the time it gets to the individual, there's all this criteria for them. And, you know, it gets cut because it needs to get cut because that's the way the operation runs. But for us, we're in the blockchain space. You know, for us, we saw the technology that was available and the fact that you could go directly to the individual, and that just really sparked our approach.
It sounds like this system would be a great solution for the payment protection plan or something like that, where, you know, the government was having a really hard time sending checks out efficiently to everybody, or, you know, doing the direct deposit, and the banks weren't ready, but the government was. And then it was just kind of chaotic. But it sounds like your system is built to, in times of need, distribute funds and allocate capital across societies correctly. And is that, correct me if I'm wrong?
I think that's an inherent part of cryptocurrencies, which are, you know, on a public, you know, decentralized network that's stable. And so that's not, just specifically for us. And I think that's the discussion where the conversation where central bank digital currencies have really come to the forefront, saying that, you know, we could have been more efficient had, you know, we had a central bank digital currency, the US dollar equivalent. For us, we're much the same way, I think, in a broader stroke, that, you know, it is definitely possible to address the individual directly. And I think that's the kind of conversation, or that's the kind of more, not necessarily trickle up effect, because, you know, we talk about the existing banking system or the existing financial markets. They work. I mean, of course, this is a very time of extreme stress and so on and so forth. For the most part, if you have a stable, non-corrupt government with transparency, these things work. I mean, they're still excluding the you know, the very vulnerable or the lower socioeconomic classes, right? But the ones that are already, quote unquote, unbanked, and people are trying to bank them into a current system, there's a reason why they're unbanked in the very first place. And it's because the system just, they just don't qualify. You can't just give someone access and suddenly they're qualified and they're no longer unbanked because they have $5 in their ATM, but the ATM fee is still a dollar, right? And that's literally 20%. Fee for them, right? Not to mention, like, you know, the monthly fees. For us, I think when we looked at what decentralization could actually happen is that we could actually create value from creating this kind of decentralized, by creating a decentralized network. And the one that we chose was creating a decentralized information network that would report on basically what was going on in emerging markets in these urban slums where there's no data, and gathering that data and creating transparency there, and then rewarding the reporting of that data. And that's, you know, the approach that we took as well, because the nature of cryptocurrencies is that it can create this new kind of system, which is inclusive because it's just by its nature inclusive. I mean, a decentralized network doesn't exist unless it's inclusive. And so, you know, that's really the approach. But this project itself, I think it took about 2.5 years to really get off the ground. It took me about 2 years to write the white paper. It was like, ended up being like 141 pages. So,
wow. That's quite the tome. I'm curious, at what stage of development is the business in, or the organization?
Okay. So, we have listed ARCC, but we're entirely self-funded, but we ended up getting in, investment to support the reserve itself. So it's Asia Reserve Currency Coin. ARCC is the micro asset that we launched. And we have a full team. We have three dev teams. One is co-development with Algorand in Boston. And then we have another Boston dev team. And then we have another dev team in Singapore. And we're simultaneously doing three devs at the same time. One is a microfinance platform, which also is that decentralized information network I was mentioning before. And that's being done with Algorand. And then we have two other projects. One is a really cool project called Messe, micro equity stock exchange, where we take US like FANG stocks, and then we've tokenized them into 1/10,000th of an increment. And like a stable coin, we're holding the actual asset, but we're going to basically have a micro exchange where, let's say for Tesla, I don't know what the price is right now, but I assume it's somewhere like 700. At 1/10,000th of a share, it's 7 cents. But if Tesla keeps its Teron going, imagine like where in the world could you have 7 cents and make 10% on it, whether it's annually or whatever? You can't, right? And I think that's one project we're really happy about, and we're in co-development there as well. And then we have
looks awesome.
Yeah. We have another project that's ongoing as well. It's called Algolotto.io. We're in development right now with our Boston team. And what that is, it's basically a risk-free lottery. And Algorand provides...
It's like Pool Together? Rewards.
It's like Pool Together, but it's going to be a little bit different. It's going to have a Pool Together element, but it's also going to have like a 649 actual jackpot, which we are going to also back as well. So we have... something like 13 million algos. I have to check the exact number. So we have a lot of algos in our reserve, which the staking rewards we're going to put towards a jackpot. But that is just basically to introduce people and onboard them to what cryptocurrencies are and completely be risk-free. It's not in a competition or a way to get into the lottery market. I mean, the actual amounts will be quite small, but it's a way for us to provide another service, and specifically to emerging markets.
Talk about the idea behind a risk-free lottery.
Okay, so I'm from gaming. So I used to be the regional director of PokerStars in Asia from 2007 to 2010. And I know poker well, and I know gaming really well. I actually legalized poker in Macau. So before me, it wasn't legal. And then after me, we had worked on it. And so I know everything about online gaming, actually online casinos, sports betting, so on and so forth. But you know, the biggest thing is the biggest gaming product actually in the world that people don't think is a gaming product is lotteries. Lotteries are basically, most of them around the world are nationalized. So they're not private lotteries, and they're not very transparent. So when you have a lottery and let's say it's a 649 draw, so six numbers, 49, you don't actually know what the number of participants are. They're not very transparent on that, right? But the reality is, you know, you have profit margins anywhere between 30 to 50%. But what's amazing about lotteries are that it serves a really good social purpose because it's extremely accessible. The amount that you put in and the amount that you could win is so great. And even though you have a higher chance of getting struck by lightning, like even like every single day you got a chance and you could add it up, getting struck by lightning, you still have more of a chance by getting hit by lightning almost every day of the year than winning the lottery. But it creates a kind of accessible game that people can, you know, look forward to. And, you know, it does change the lives of one or two people like every week. And so in a risk-free lottery though, or any lottery, it's still actually gaming, right? So,
yeah.
You know, they've done such a great marketing thing where it's not gaming, but it is gaming. So for us, in cryptocurrencies right now, we have like that ability to do staking. And depending on which, you know, protocol you're in, the staking can either be coming out of a pool or it could be part of the consensus mechanism, right? The rewards. And when you do a risk-free lottery, this was actually set up by the banks, I believe in the 1970s, where like people who had small savings accounts and they were not doing anything with their interest, they wanted to set something up for them. Now in the US, it's not considered fully regulated. In some states, it's outright banned. But I think for cryptocurrencies, considering how volatile it is, even you holding or buying cryptocurrencies, it was a kind of investment risk, if I could say that, right?
Yes.
And in terms of what the uses of it are, especially as we get into proof of stake. We're still not there yet with these killer apps and so forth. And so for us, the Algo Lottery is just a way for us to introduce people to it, understand what staking is, and to see their rewards in action without taking any risk at all from their initial purchase of the capital. And the capital stays there as a cryptocurrency. So I think it's a great approach. I think the Pool Together team has done a great job as well. We were actually working on it months back as well, conceptually. And, you know, we didn't know about Pool Together until they actually made a press release about it and so on and so forth. So, you know, we were very impressed as well. And that actually gave us confidence to move forward with our project as well.
And just one more reminder, if you want to know what smart money is, you have to attend the Crypto Hedge Fund Summit. Sign up at CryptoHedgeFundSummit.com. We're talking with some of the brightest minds in this space about what smart money is, what they do, and how to follow it. If you're even halfway serious about investing in crypto, this is a can't-miss event.
That's exactly right, guys. We speak with investing professionals, conducted a ton of interviews, and they're all yours for free. All you got to do is sign up for a free ticket, right? CryptoHedgeFundSummit.com. It's going to be a lot of fun, guys. We hope to see you guys there.
There's so much there that I want to really unpack before we continue to move forward. You mentioned you have a micro equities exchange. That is revolutionary. That's one of the coolest things, one of the craziest things that just might actually work towards actually having wealth trickle down to the people that need it the most. Is this something that is accessible worldwide, or is it restricted to only certain regions?
It's going to be only accessible to certain regions, and we're in like the kind of beta setup for it. So the exchange itself is not too hard to set up, and the tokens and the assets are already being created. So if you go to, you know, my Algo Explorer, algoexplorer.com, you can actually find it. Or if you download the Algorand wallet, if you just check out assets, I think you'll be able to see all the assets we've done, and it'll be like M/Tesla or M dash like MS.
Interesting.
Whatever. Yeah. So it's all done. We're trying to figure out which target market we're going to look at. And we've already made some rules on it, like because it's being backed by the asset itself. So if anyone actually acquired all 10,000 shares, we would give them the stock itself, number mm-hmm. one. Number two is that we're not going to let it trade 30% higher or lower than the actual divisible price, because we don't want to turn this into like a speculative, like crazy micro gambling.
No, that's brilliant.
Market. Yeah. So we're just in talks with one major white label provider. And the reason why we're in talks with them is because every single country has its own different regulatory body. So when we launch Messi initially, it's really more of a proof of concept to show people, here it is, but we're not going to launch it in any particular market to begin with. Rather, we're going to use it as proof of concept to show countries and say, look, this is something that you can put in and we will get the regulatory side done. So whether it's stocks within your country or whether it's US tech-based stocks, things that can be divided into 1/10,000th that have liquidity. And here you go. And then create a kind of cloud exchange where, you know, basically anyone where we can get like the regulatory approval for can buy into these either US tech stocks or European tech stocks, these really high growth stocks, where, you know, 10 cents makes a difference, right?
Yeah.
And I think this really comes down to one thing, is that what people don't realize is that when you're in an emerging market, it's impossible to save money. It's always a short-term survival. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in this kind of mindset that you just want to like survive, or you only have to survive, then you can't really create any assets or investments. It just doesn't work that way. And then people will say, well, I go to like Thailand, I go to like Vietnam, I go to Philippines or Indonesia, and I see people watching around with cell phones, or they're drinking like lattes from Starbucks and so on and so forth, or they're like, the movies are packed when you go to India. And there's this book called Poor Economics, and it was written by two MIT professors. They just won the Nobel Economic Prize this year, but the book itself, Poor Economics, was written in 2006. And they basically highlight this kind of paradoxical thing where when your life is so shitty, right, it's these small consumer purchases that make your life fulfilling, because that's all you can really have, are these short-term, really short-term kind of fulfillment of, you know, your life. Whereas then you go back to your shitty life and your daily thing to survive. And so I think for this particular project, what we wanted to do was, like, even when we first launch, we basically want to just give out, you know, 20,000 of these stocks, these micro stocks, to just show them that, yes, you know, even this small amount can work, and you can make these profits. Because when you're, let's say you only have $10 and someone says, hey, you know what, I'll give you 100% interest annual on it. And you're like, okay, well, that's only gonna be $20. It's not something that, you know, you can really conceptualize as a lot of money, right? Because, you know, capital needs capital to really grow. But in this case, I think if we can, like, link them to what the rest of the world is doing, because it really boggles my mind. It's like 2020, our, like, cell phones have enough power to, like, send a guy to the moon. And yet, you know, this technology, which is completely accessible on a commercial side, hasn't really, you know, solved some really basic things where, like, you know, you don't have running water, you don't have this kind of infrastructure development. People are living as if it's the 1930s. And I think it's just completely inexcusable. And I think it's a matter of exposure. So once we can get people exposed that this technology is there, you can actually make interest. Capital does actually work, not just, you know, you're looking at, like, a lot of microfinance organizations and they're, like, really inwardly focused and they say, okay, let's get all these ladies to do handicrafts. That's great. I'm not, you know, bagging on handicrafts and scarves and stuff like that. But what if we got these ladies to be investing in US tech equities?
Right. That's the main point right there.
Yeah. Yeah, that exposure and learning about what these technologies are and, like, having their children to really dream or parents to really support that and really look beyond these slums. Because it's really crazy, because in these emerging markets, you have these slums, which are right beside, like, five-star hotels, right? I mean, they see it, but they're not touching it. So they think it's just far away. And I want them to touch it. I want them to grab a hold of it.
Yeah.
Because there's no reason they shouldn't be.
Absolutely. No, I'm super bullish on that entire idea right there of being able to get all these micro equities in the hands of everybody. Everybody in the world should be able to have exposure to, you know, the same investment vehicles that the average American does or the average, you know, Hong Kong citizen. So I think that's really cool. I want to hop over to our discussion on Algorand. You are in particular, you know, quite an expert. You're building on Algorand. What makes it special? Why'd you choose it? Tell us a little bit about the team, because honestly, this is the first time that we've talked about Algorand in depth on our podcast. So give us the 101.
Okay, cool. So Algorand, I think they launched just this past summer, and we were in talks with Algorand since about May of last year. So, oh my gosh, it's been like a year now. And Algorand was founded in 1997 by Silvio. I forget his last name. I don't want to butcher his last name, but he was a Turing winner and he's been an MIT prof since 1983. And he's invented all these, like, zero proof knowledge works and stuff like that. So a lot of things in cryptography he's actually co-invented. And he went off as a professor and he founded Algorand. And the name Algorand is a blend of random and I'm so tongue tied right now.
Algorithm and random, I suppose, right?
Yes, there you go.
There it is.
Yeah, and you know, they went off and like professors normally don't do that. So he risked a lot to do it, and they did a proof of stake chain, and they were very aggressive. Or not aggressive, I guess, really hardworking in getting the right partners and enterprises on. And they're a public blockchain. And, you know, they actually have, they're providing the technology for the Marshall Islands central bank digital currency, which would be the first one in the world.
Wow.
Yeah. And they have a very, very strong team executives. They have a massive brain trust. And what was really appealing to these guys was not only were they actively pursuing us, was that we're such a loon shot. I mean, you talked about, like, you know, copycat products. Well, we're really not that. I mean, we are, in fact, before Libra came out, anyone that I would explain this to, they'd be like, what's a reserve currency? You know, the social impact thing, that's nice, but what's financial inclusion? And what do you mean banking the unbanked? Doesn't people, like, really have bank accounts? And if they don't, do they really need one? I mean, like, no one on this side of the Pacific had any idea about what financial inclusion or banking the unbanked was until, like, Libra came out. But Algorand, they did. And I mean, they really embraced us as a loon shot, because I think in some respects they are a loon shot as well. And they recently came out with their Algorand 2.0, which allowed you to really tokenize assets extremely quickly. It's on a command line function. It's not a kind of, they have a smart contract set up as well called Teal, but it's really limited. And the reason and the rationale behind that was that unlike Ethereum smart contracts, they wanted to have a very more narrow kind of point of exposures. So they, you know, it was kind of very clear, you know, what would be the consequences of, you know, these smart contracts and kind of focused. And so once they launched, we were basically the first, what they call Algorand standard assets launch. It's like, you could think about like equivalent to an ERC-20 token almost on their network. And we're the first ones to list. And then USDT came on shortly thereafter. And, you know, now Algorand is kind of really in that middle of that discussion of providing technology and to like the central bank digital currency field, as well as, you know, different enterprises. And another partner of ours, Republic, which does crowdsource funding for high tech projects. I mean, they've signed on to go on to the Algorand chain as well for, I believe, a securities token offering. So yeah, they're great. They're based out in Boston, in Back Bay, they have a full team going. And I would say no one has accomplished as much as they have accomplished in the short period of time in terms of being really enterprise focused. So, and they're really strongly backed as well.
That's really fascinating. I knew a little bit about Algorand, but that was a tremendous breakdown. And I had no idea that they already had that much adoption and stuff like that. We've actually had the founder of Republic on the podcast, Kendrick, before.
Yep.
He's a phenomenal guy. If you haven't gone to republic.co to check out the different equities that anyone can invest in right now, I'd say that would be the yin to Messi's yang. If you want to get involved in early stage equities, you can go to republic.co and check out that platform. Absolutely phenomenal what they're doing over there. I know Bryce and I are going to give a much deeper dive into Algorand here in the near future. So thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Absolutely.
Now let's talk about the token you built on it, ARCC. Is this a speculative asset or is it backed by anything? Like, what actually gives this thing value?
Okay, so I'm super old school. I'm like 45 years old. And I read the Bitcoin white paper, like, I think 30 times, right? And then I finally got it probably around the 25th time or something like that. But what was really clear to me was that Bitcoin really had this utility that the more people were on this decentralized network, the greater the security was, you know, and the more the game theory really kicked in. And, you know, creating a currency, if you're a country, is really difficult. Creating a cryptocurrency looks like it's easy technically, but conceptually, it's even three times more difficult because you're not a sovereign country. You know, you're a bunch of individuals coming together and you're creating it. And so I am not as smart as Satoshi Nakamoto, and I am not anywhere as smart as even any of these pioneers like Silvio, but I am a strategist. And for me, you know, you always want to look at the low-hanging fruit that has optionality, and then with that optionality kind of move on to the next step. So when I looked at this entire idea of cryptocurrencies and how it could benefit, the biggest problem I could think of was the emerging market problem and that kind of economic development thing. I thought, if this is going to act as an incentive for a decentralized network, it has to have value right off the bat, other than just the value you get from participating in a decentralized network. So we backed it. We backed it with 700,000 US of US high-tech companies, startups, just like Republic. And this is how I actually met Republic. We actually invested in a 3D rocket ship printing company called Relativity alongside Republic. And we added it to our kind of base of assets. And then in our portfolio.
Hold on. Did you say 3D printed rocket ships?
Yeah, Relativity. It's cool. I met the founder. They followed them, I think, from Y Combinator, but the head of the guy is the ex-head of Bezos's Blue Origin outfit. He was head of the 3D printing division. Yeah. But he went off and he says, okay, well, I want to print the whole thing, you know, whatever. And he makes the smaller rockets, but he literally 3D prints the whole thing. And what's different about it is that in Tesla or in the other rocket ship companies like Mr. Bezos's whatever company, they print 3D parts, but they don't print the whole thing. And it's a kind of entirely different kind of value proposition, right?
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Back to the amazing basket of assets you have here. Yeah. Continue rattling them off.
Yeah, and then we basically bought a ton of Bitcoin. Not a ton, but enough. And then we put them into like Bitcoin funds, BNB, Binance Coin. And we have about, let's say about 2.5, 2.6 million of algos and about a million of Bitcoin.
So there's a stable coin that's issued backed by all these assets, right?
Yeah. So it's not really a stable coin. It's a reserve coin. And I think what the difference is that a stable coin, it wants to maintain a stable value. And so you had Basis and you have all these other Terra who are trying to create a stable value. We're not trying to create a stable value. We're just trying to create the most robust reserve we can. And what I mean by that is that if you're not from America, you will know this. But if you're from America, you have no idea what a reserve currency is, because the US dollar is the world's reserve currency. I mean, you can't get another piece of currency that is more stable or more robust in a time of crisis than the US dollar, except for gold, right? And so like, let's say in Singapore or in South Korea, where I've worked and spent, majority of my work life in, when there is, let's give an example of South Korea. We're basically a total export country. That's it. We're like, 50 million people packed in the size of like half the size of Vermont or like whatever, and or above the size of Vermont. And all we do is export. And when there's like a world lack of demand for our products, the Korean won starts to drop like crazy, right? And in order for us to keep the Korean won up, we hold US dollars or yen or euros in a reserve that we use to buy the Korean won back from the market and keep the price up, right? And the whole thing about that strategy is that if you hold enough in your reserves and people know that you are the last buyer of last resort, then in terms of people putting sell pressure down on your national currency, it's not as likely. There are a lot more easier targets to kind of go after, because people, currency speculators, basically look for these opportunities to short currencies and create instability as well on the global forex market. So in the same way as a reserve currency, all we're really concerned about is the assets that are held by the reserve and the inflow of assets into the reserve. And so, we have a portfolio right now that's a little unbalanced, but it's basically about 80% cryptocurrencies and 20% high-tech investments, which are two of the most volatile investments possible. Yeah, I know it's not a really good start, but we're going to diversify and stabilize a little bit more. But the whole point of it is that we want to create a kind of base value with the reserve to say, like, look, we're the buyer of last resort, and then this is what the reserve has, and this is the amount of coins in circulation. And then on the other side of that is, the asset management, the kind of microfinance projects that we're doing, such as Algo Lotto, such as Messe, and having that inflow and that user base also contribute to the reserve. So anything that we raise through the listing, through our actions in the listing, or any revenue that we get from Algo Lotto or Messe or ARCC1, which is going to be our microfinance platform, 80% goes towards the reserve. For anything that we make, and then anything that was raised, 90 to 95% goes into the reserve. And so all we're trying to do is increase the price of the reserve and then have the listing price kind of there as the price discovery of what the market feels this is worth. And then use that as our kind of incentive piece where, we are giving out this ARCC for people to do the reporting as a reward and for them to see, okay, look, this is the ARCC, this is how it's growing, this is how the reserve is growing, and this is how much it's worth for my time.
Awesome. It's almost like you guys are playing the role of like the Federal Reserve too, as we're seeing, as they're inflating their balance sheet by buying up debt and issuing dollars based on, cash flows from that debt. You guys are kind of taking the opposite approach where you guys are issuing tokens based on assets, not debt. I think that's a really cool idea.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because, you know, we based our economic modeling on how Ray Dalio looks at the market. Mm. And the way that Ray Dalio looks at the market is he looks at it as a series of transactions. And, you know, for him on a macro level, how he has made his money, so he says. And so I've read and so I've learned from his readings and his works is, you know, that credit debt cycle. And, right. You know, it's really great because he ties it really back down to like productivity again. And for us, our theory is that you can have the credit debt cycle, but technology is moving towards singularity. And what that really means is that you have these network effects, not decentralized network effects, but just network effects in general. And when you have something like Google or Facebook and they have these network effects, they pull off so much cash, give off so much cash, you don't need credit or debt, right? Because they are so efficient in amalgamating all of that transactions and then multiplying the value of it,
right?
That if you were to actually create a decentralized network that was able to have those transactions, but also to be very transparent in people's participation, then would you really need credit or debt? Right. And that's the theory that we're kind of working on, that you wouldn't. It's a lot easier said than done, obviously. I mean, I spent like now, like 3 years kind of going through it all. And I hope that I'm not wrong. But I've been studying like game networks and stuff like that since grad school. So I'm pretty sure.
You're pretty sure you're onto something.
Yeah. Hope so.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. Like, I think that you are completely onto something. It makes so much sense. It's really the ethos of what Satoshi started. I mean, not started, I would say implemented, but again, you know, we talk about a lot of the times Pizza Mind here, you know, these were all ideas that were floating around in the 60s, in the 70s with Austrian economics. And then, you know, these monetary theorists talking about digital currencies and when the web, you know, for dozens of years. Right. And so you are now taking your place, you know, in the history books, and there's going to be, you're standing on the shoulders of giants, and you're about to have other giants stand on the shoulders of you as we build out this new world with basically one that isn't built on debt and built on issuing credit and mortgaging assets. And it's a world that is now the right side up. Whereas now we're in the current world, we're living in the upside down. It feels like sometimes when I read these headlines at the CNBC.
Yeah. And you know, like towards that, I mean, like COVID is such a brutal crisis, but you know, they always say, don't let a good crisis go to waste. And I think this is really that moment, that watershed moment where, you know, you have like the tide that rises all boats. And when the tide is out, you really see the cracks. And then you look at the United States, which is the richest country in the world by far. And you have these cracks, like these massive cracks, small business owners, individuals, who you could ignore before. And there needs to be a solution. And even you look at the WHO and how they've handled, like when they've recognized the pandemic and so on and so forth. I myself am very critical of how they have done up to what they've done. But the fact of the matter is we didn't have information on the ground. We didn't have individuals. We had people tweeting. We had people on Facebook. But the problem with those things is that it's not coordinated into a network. It's basically you get awareness. But who's to know whether it's fake news or not fake news, or who do you know it's like the non-lockdown people or the lockdown people are correct? It's really difficult because you just don't have data. And, you know, with a decentralized network, especially the one that we're trying to really form up, we're just trying to get the data. And we're trying to get the data where the data has the most validity. You know, for instance, I'm lucky. I had an exit. Sold a fintech company, like national fintech company, to Alibaba and CP Group. And CP Group, I think a lot of your listeners won't know, but they're the biggest conglomerate in Thailand. They're 30% bigger than Samsung Electronics. Whoa. So they're humongous. Yeah. I mean, like, it's funny because like, I've been in New York for the last 2 years and we talk, and then like I name drop a little bit just to like say like, you know, what I've done, whatever. And people are like, oh, okay. You know, but what if I'm in Hong Kong or something and people are like, wow, oh my God, you know? So it's just kind of funny, but
yeah, in America, we're really in our own bubble for sure.
Yeah. But you know, what's interesting all about that is that, you know, you have now, you know, people who could really, if we can create these networks, right, these decentralized networks, and people could really see what the data is on the ground. If we had another pandemic, then we would say, you know, look, we can't pinpoint exactly, you know, individuals who are doing this, but we can aggregate and say, you know, in these places where they are not taken care of, this is what's really happening. And going back to this point is that I'm lucky. I live in New York City. I live in the Upper East Side. We're fairly well off. When things were happening that were bad in New York, we were already in our ski condo in Vermont, and we just didn't come back. Or other people went to the Hamptons, or other people who are upper middle class, they could stock up on food. But for everybody else who it really was super damaging for, you didn't know how much the damage was until the infection really spread. They didn't have the right information. They had nowhere to report it. They couldn't get testing. You know, people are like getting conflicted ideas, whether they wear a mask, whether they go to the clinic or not. And, you know, this is the real exposure. And this is the real exposure of like this kind of top down kind of, we know what's kind of going on approach, when it's something that people don't really know what's going on. It's beyond our control. I mean, there was definitely a failure of leadership here. Being South Korean, every one of us, all the boys, all the men, we have to go for conscription. I was lucky. I got exempted because I was raised abroad. And when I came back, I was a little bit too old and I was studying my master's. But my sons, who were both born in South Korea, they have to go. And so we've always lived under this kind of threat of North Korea right above us, right? We don't really care if North Korea threatens to do a nuke because they've been threatening since like 97. So we're kind of desensitized to it. But we also had SARS a few years back in early 2000s, which I was there when it happened. So when this crisis happened, we were able to react because we're not that far away from these crises and, you know, the physical threat of life and death. But in America and a lot of these other Western countries, I feel like it's all about globalization and commerce and growth. And even these massive organizations, whether it would be the IMF or even WHO, where they couldn't switch gears fast enough, that their entire leadership was about the economy and they didn't realize it's no longer about the economy, it's about life and death. And everyone's getting shut down. Like supply and demand is going down at the same time. What do we really need to do? And who really got hurt here, who didn't have any voice at all, were the disenfranchised, the marginalized. And again, not to downplay what happened in the United States, but what's happening in emerging markets is that people will start to die. People will start to riot. And, you know, something like Ecuador, something that you've seen that already. And people and children are going to go through periods of malnutrition that are going to affect them for the rest of their lives because of this event. And this is something that I want to do everything that we can to prevent this from happening or give them a voice. You know, the biggest thing about this project is that it's always been a loon shot. And, you know, we talked about how long, you know, I ended up doing like a, you know, whatever, 171 page white paper. And originally when I had first written it, and I kind of showed people in 2017, and it was like 35 pages, and they're like, oh man, Sinjin, this is too long. You're never going to be able to do anything about it. Like just split it up into this one little bit and just do it, you know, and, or just do a gaming project. You know, you're big in gaming. You get raised like 20 million. I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to do a project because I see the potential here of it. And for the longest time, you know, you're always looking for validation for a particular project because, you know, you want to get validated. You want people to say, hey, that's a really good idea. And nobody would, you know, everyone was really into the market hype and stuff like that. Now I'm older. So I was a grad student when the entire internet boom was happening. And, you know, I've seen mobile gaming come and go and, you know, online gaming. So I've been through almost like three of these cycles. And I was like, no, I'm going to build out for the long term. And, you know, I'll put my money where my mouth is and just do it. But there are a lot of times where I'm like, oh, well, why doesn't anyone really care? And, you know, like I went to a lot of investment seminars and conferences where it's like social impact and so on and so forth. And I think it's all bullshit. Honestly, I think this entire thing is lip service to like social impact and doing things that really make a difference. Because there's a certain kind of social impact that people want to have. And it's very PR-y. It's very like packaged well. But real economic development is super messy and it's super life and death and it's super hardcore because the people who are maintaining these systems of exploitation, they're powerful, evil, sociopathic people, right? Who have fully dehumanized their own population, right? And at one point, I think last year, I just realized, fuck it. You know, this is my goal. It's a worthy goal. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Anyone who says, you know, it's too big, it's too much of a scope, oh, it can't happen, you know, you can't do an entire economic system. Fuck it. Fuck them. Fuck you. You know, I'm just going to get it done because it just got to get done. You know, how long are these countries going to be emerging markets for? You know?
Yeah. And that's what I meant at the very beginning when I was talking about making every moment count and really living your life like it matters. David, I want to talk to you for another several hours, but we have to say goodbye for now. But we're definitely going to bring you back on the podcast because there's so much more to talk about with what's going on in the world and your various projects. I want to say thank you for everything that you do. And I'm not going to ask you any of the closing questions. We're going to save that for part two when we bring you back on. So for now, Crypt Nation, we will see you again soon. And David, thanks again for all your time.
Cheers. Thanks, Eugene.